You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 29th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. It's vacation week here at the Majority Report. I'm on vacation. Matt and Michael are on vacation. Everybody's on vacation. Yet we've left a little goodie for you. an interview I did with Lawrence Lessig on this program about over a year and a half ago or so. Also, an interview I did with Anita Fett. She is one of those advocates who helps explain what goes on in the Affordable Care Act health exchanges. It's an interview I did about a month ago at Families USA. It will explain for you what to expect if you're one of those people who are eligible for the Affordable Care Act exchanges, which are going to go into effect just about 9 months from now. And then also later in the program, Asif Manvi from almost 2 years ago now. Well, I guess over 2 years ago. No, about a year and a half ago, as he gives me some film recommendations. All part of our vacation week casual Friday show, folks. But there's nothing casual about it. Let's be honest. You're going to love it. We've assembled it for you. And then on Monday, one more archive show for all of you. It is the 9th anniversary of the launch of the Majority Report on Air America Radio with Janine and I. And as such, I thought it was apropos to play the first ever Majority Report with Bill Maher, Atrios, Dave Chappelle, Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's. Yes. Yes, folks. That's what it was back in the day. So enjoy today's show. Talk to you on Monday. We'll be back live on Tuesday.
So, Professor, one way forward. Tell me this ultimately comes down for you in terms of our political system. And I should say also, you have been tell me essentially the main message of one way forward.
Well, so the world, meaning political pundits, divide American politics into the left side versus the right side. And I think the most important division today is not so much the left side versus the right side as it is the inside versus the outside. And what we've seen over the past, I think, decade, as I describe in the book, is wave after wave of this kind of grassroots outsider political movement that are not, you know, politician wannabes or people who are like finding another way into becoming congressmen or senators or presidents, but instead people who have just for various reasons, grown increasingly disgusted or outraged or frustrated with their government and are, you know, taking it upon themselves to do something to change it. And I think we're in one of these really critical moments right now with these outsider movements. Obviously the Occupy movement is one part of it. But I also, in the book, try to argue that I think the Tea Party, the grassroots part of the Tea Party, is another one of these movements. And I think the opportunity right now is for these very different movements with very different values to recognize that, in fact, though they don't have a common end, they have a common enemy. And the common enemy is the corruption of this government by the corrupting influence of money inside of politics, and that that blocks the left and the right from getting what they want from our government, and that we have an opportunity to work, you know, across these partisan divisions to force change in this government that might end that corrupting influence.
Now, you started, I guess it was now about 4-5 years ago, after sort of spending 10 years of your career focusing on copyright issues and developing basically a new form of copyright. You set out to sort of figure out how to fix what was wrong with our government. At what point in this process, and maybe it was just at the beginning, did you come to this to see what was broken in the context of our government to be an insider versus outsider split?
Well, I think that, you know, the work I did with copyright and the internet was the first demonstration of that. You know, I started working in that field probably about 12 or 14 years ago and became something of an activist as I saw, I really was a lawyer with a guilty conscience as I saw the law grow in ways that was really destructive to the internet and really to the traditions of copyright law. And as, you know, I and many others were pushing for people to recognize the need not to abolish copyright but to update it to a digital age, we saw that, you know, parents and businesses and educators and, you know, like all the ordinary people out there were understanding the need and recognizing and agreeing that there needed to be this kind of update. But policymakers, you know, Congress, were making no progress at all. Indeed, you know, you would talk to them and they wouldn't even recognize that there was another side to the issue. They just had heard only one side to the issue. And they'd heard only one side for the obvious reason that, you know, the public domain didn't have a lobbyist and wasn't going to get a lobbyist or wasn't going to be channeling millions of dollars in campaign funds into the system. And so, therefore, that side was just absent from the debate. It didn't lose the debate. It just was absent from the debate. And it began to make, you know, a kind of obvious point inescapable, which was we weren't going to make any progress on this esoteric issue of copyright, and not just esoteric issues like copyright, you know, fundamental issues like global warming or environmental issues or real healthcare issues or even for people on the right, simpler taxes or smaller government. We're going to make no progress on any of those issues so long as we had this corrupt system governing the process in Washington. So it was that recognition that, you know, actually outsiders from the political system were pretty good at figuring this stuff out, and the insiders were systematically blocked that led me to say we had to figure a way to fix that ultimate corruption.
So, you know, one of the troubles, I mean, let's, you know, for the sake of argument, I mean, I'm a little more skeptical of the Tea Party, perhaps, than you are. But for the sake of the argument, let's accept the premise that we're looking at, you know, different grassroots here, because I do think I do tend to agree with you that the primary issue of our day is this notion of insiders versus outsiders. But how do you bridge this notion of, like, even when you talk about it in terms of how you came to sort of see the dysfunction in our government in the concept of issues of, like, public domain, of how do you bridge this gap when you talk about solutions to empower people over the big money institutions? They necessarily require some type of activism coming from the collective. In other words, it may be regulation, or maybe there's other solutions that you can talk to that don't necessarily conflict with some of the agendas, let's say, on the right. This is one of the sort of the sticking points that I always sort of bump up against. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they don't conflict. I think that the insight is that we've got to find a way to exert power on the structures of our government. Not, you know, I think one of the mistakes the Tea Party made was so quickly trying to become kind of insiders inside of Washington. And it's led to, you know, a weakening of their movement because I think, you know, that splits the movement and half of them are in favor of what the Republicans are doing. The other half is disgusted. I think the key is that we got to recognize that it's the system itself that has become corrupted. It's not because we've got too many Rob Blagojeviches in Washington. Indeed, I think from that in that sense of corruption, you know, we've got the cleanest Congress in the history of Congress. They're not filled with people committing criminal acts. What instead they're filled with is people who are inside a system where they can't help but focus their attention on the interest of those who fund their campaigns. And the people who fund their campaigns are the tiniest fraction of the 1%, right? So 0.26% of Americans give more than $200 in a congressional campaign. 0.05% give a maximum amount to any candidate. 0.01%, the 1% of the 1%, give more than $10,000 in an election cycle. So in a system where they're so obsessed with what this tiny slice of the 1% wants, they are drawn away from what America wants, and we have to recognize that as America and you know, break them of this dependency. You know, they need an intervention. We need to intervene and take the bottle away and get them to focus again on what they're supposed to focus on.
Is this sort of problem that we have? I mean, there's plenty of studies to show. I think the most prominent of which comes out of Princeton, which shows that over the past 30 years, whenever there's a policy conflict, it does not break down on partisan lines or left and right lines or party lines. It is always the policy. If there is a policy preference difference between essentially moneyed interest and people in general, it always falls in favor of the moneyed interest. Is this a really sort of just a reemergence of a battle between people and the establishment? I mean, is this a new phenomenon, or is it one that we've been dealing with maybe for 40, 45 years?
Well, it comes in cycles. I think an interesting referent point is 1912, you know, when the progressive movement, which was not a bunch of liberals, it was, you know, people from all political stripes who called themselves progressives. And in the 1912 election, there were two candidates who called themselves progressives. And between the two of them, they garnered 70% of the vote of the American people. So I think that, we've been fighting this kind of issue again and again over our history. But it changes, it morphs into something different. So 100 years ago, the kind of corruption they were fighting was the corruption of bribery, you know, crass quid pro quo bribery. And I think the corruption we're seeing now has nothing to do with that kind of crass bribery. It's just as effective. Indeed, I think it's even more destructive. But it's not people violating the law. And so I think that this version of corruption actually is... It's at its acute form only relatively recently. You know, I think it's actually just after Gingrich took over as Speaker and Congress radically changed its way of behaving and shifted into this full-time war mode of constant fundraising, constant battle to retake control in the next election, that we began to see Congress become something very different from what it was originally. But, you know, there's no doubt that we've been fighting issues like this since time immemorial. We just have to fight it in new and different forms.
Okay, we're talking to Professor Lawrence Lessig about his new book, One Way Forward. When we come back, let's talk more about what steps can be taken to further identify the common enemy, and then what's the next step after that, and how can that next step following the identification of what the real problem is, how do you implement those policies, particularly across ideological lines? We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is a fake break. So, Professor Lessig, we were talking in the first half of before the break about the disparate, theoretically, ideologically different groups in this country who are grassroots oriented, who see that one of the biggest problems that we have in this country is more of an inside insiders versus outsiders, outsiders versus insiders problem, rather than any ideological differences that we have in terms of sort of subsidiary issues, that we have a structural problem in this country. Mm-hmm. Once that's identified, is that where, once there's broader acceptance of that, and to a certain extent there is pretty broad acceptance of it, how do you fix these things, both from the challenges that exist procedurally and the challenges that are brought up by having disparate ideologies want to apply their ideological fixes for this?
Yeah. So first we got to identify what the fix is. And in my view, the fix is recognizing that the only way to reform a system where Congress is dependent on the funders, but the funders are not the people, the only way to reform that system is to make it so the funders are the people, so that when they're responsive to the funders, they're responsive to us. And the way to do that is to adopt a kind of small-dollar, citizen-funded model for elections, where in my version that I describe, everybody gets the first $50 of tax revenue that they pay to the government sent back to them in the form of a democracy voucher. And with that voucher, they can give it to any member of Congress or candidate for Congress who agrees to fund his or her campaign with vouchers only, plus contributions of citizens of up to $100. So that would fund an election system. Actually, that amount of money is three times the total amount that was spent in 2010. That would fund an election system where the money didn't come from the top 1% or the top fraction of 1%. It would be coming from all of us. And so that when Congress did something stupid, it was not because they were bought. It was because they just did the wrong thing, and we'd have a democratic reason to respond. That's what I think we got to be aiming for, plus changes to the Supreme Court's crazy Citizens United decision. But then the question is, so what is it that would bring about that kind of change? Because the biggest block here is not, you know, identifying the problem or figuring out what a solution to the problem looks like. The biggest block is figuring out a way to put enough pressure on that institution to get it to do the right thing. And that's why I think the outsiders movements that I'm talking about have got to begin to up the ante and talk about the fundamental constitutional authority in this nation to guide and direct the government to do what the government should be doing. So, I think if we can get people to focus on establishing rules for this game that we can trust, and bracketing for the moment very important differences between the left and the right. You know, I consider myself from the left. I have very important views about egalitarian tax policies, about human rights, about, you know, healthcare, global warming. These are issues that are very important to me. But I think we have to finally recognize neither side's going to get anything we're fighting for until we address this fundamental problem first. And we need a strategy for doing that.
And the proposal where it's almost a there seems to be in this proposal embedded in the proposal you just discussed a not enough government restriction to offend the sensibilities of the constitutional sensibilities, sensibilities about overreach by government, sensibilities about the role of money as speech, but it's a combination of essentially just asking the government just off of the vouchers, and then it's about public shame in some respects.
Yeah, you offer the vouchers, you give Congress congresspeople and candidates a reason to use them. And then if they don't opt into using them, you shame them. You know, so when Connecticut adopted a similar program, not exactly what I've described, but a similar small-dollar funded election system, in the first year of that system, 78% of elected representatives used the small-dollar funded system. You know, Republicans and Democrats alike. Because it just made sense. It made sense because it was easier for them to fund their campaigns. They wouldn't spend as much time raising money. And because they didn't want to be known as the person who was taking money from the special interest as opposed to taking money from everybody inside in the state. So I think we need to, you know, if we created that alternative, we would create enormous opportunity for people in Congress and running for Congress to do the right thing. And then we'd create a reason for people like us to begin to believe in what they did again, as opposed to as most of us believe, having a cynical assumption whenever we see them doing something that we don't like.
Well, Professor Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for your time today. The book is One Way Forward, and now it gets back to the pavement to try and push for this type of reform.
Great. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks. Every day.
All right, continuing our coverage here at Families USA Action 2013. Joining me now is Anita Fett. She is the Director of State Assistance at Enroll America. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization whose mission is to ensure that all Americans are enrolled in and retain health coverage. So welcome to the program, Anita.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I imagine the... your challenges right now have to deal with the risk pools, states to say. Is that right or no?
Well, so we're actually working to make sure that really no matter what coverage is available in states, whether they're a state-based exchange, a partnership, or a federal exchange, that folks have an easy way to access health coverage, that the application process is easy, that they're aware of what they can enroll in, and that they actually take initiative to do so.
And so you're dealing primarily with Medicare, Medicaid, or all across the board?
So we're working primarily with the new coverage options that are coming with the Affordable Care Act. So exchange coverage and in states who expand Medicaid, Medicaid expansion coverage.
Now, the exchanges aren't set up yet, though, are they?
They're not. They're being implemented as we speak. So open enrollment starts October 1st, 2013.
For the exchanges?
For the exchanges.
Where, now... this is really, there's almost 50 different answers to this as to where we are in the process of developing these exchanges. Is that right?
You're right. There's kind of implementation across the board right now at the state and federal level.
Give me a sense of who's doing really well and who's doing poorly.
Well, there are states that we call leader states, and there are certainly states who have decided to move forward with a state-based exchange and who are pretty far along in the implementation process. Those are states like California, Maryland, and we look to those states often to see, you know, how they're doing. What kind of best practices can we glean from the implementation process in those states that we can share with states who might be a little bit farther behind? But then you also have states who are going to become a federally facilitated exchange, so the federal government's going to end up running the exchange of those states. And we've been working with the folks at the federal level to share information back and forth as well.
So, and those states that are going to become federally administered are generally states that where the politics of that state are hostile to the Affordable Care Act. Is that right?
I think sometimes the political decisions have made the states then decide to do a federal exchange. But in some cases, it's, you know, simply the states didn't have enough time to really get through the legislative process to do a state-based exchange. We expect some states who have federal exchanges may end up deciding to do a state-based exchange later on.
Okay. And so how many states is that going to look like now that the federal government is... And are they're going to be administering as well as designing these exchanges?
You're right. And there's, you know, I can't quote a number off the top of my head, but it's 30-plus states that we're expecting to have a federally run exchange.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And is that, in the end of the day, is that actually a positive? I mean, is there value to the fact that, or let me ask you this. Will the federal government be actually administering 30 different exchanges there, or will they essentially be... managing one entire exchange that 30 states are a part of?
So it's the health marketplace, and it's a single exchange that the federal government will be running. But the interface, the portal that the consumer sees, may have some state-based tailoring to it. So, but the way that the data transfers up when someone enrolls goes through a single data hub that the federal government will administer.
Okay, so from a data side, it's one. Does that mean that there is some increase in savings? Is there efficiencies? I mean... are there other implications to that aside from the fact that the data is all stored in one place?
Again, I think it's really just the state has to make the decision what's going to be best for them at this point in time. If it makes sense from a political perspective, from a cost perspective, to have the federal government come in and run the marketplace, then that's, you know, the decision that the state can make. But
what will actually happen in these exchanges?
Well, we're still trying to figure out exactly what all of this is going to look like. You know, the federal government just released the website demonstration and the model application for what an actual consumer would use to apply. And I know our staff, our policy staff, are still taking a look at that. But, you know, we're still getting information. We're still getting those.
So, I mean, but give me broad strokes. So I show up at this website and I do it through my state, New York State. Now, New York State probably has a fairly good, robust, it's probably one of those leader states that you're referring to.
Correct.
But assuming that I'm in a state that's not a leader state, I go to the site. It has my state's logo on there, but I'm going into a federal database. I put in my name, my age, how many kids I have, and any other type of information.
Sure, several other pieces of information.
And then I press a button, and it's like, then what happens?
So the vision is that you would enter all of that information, whatever information is already available. So if they can ping the Social Security Administration, they can ping tax information, they can ping other sources of data and demonstrate that to you, is this correct? And then you would say yes or no.
So they make sure that I'm me and
not
my the other guy named Sam Cedar.
Right. And then they would determine what you're actually eligible for. So are you eligible for Medicaid? Are you eligible for a tax subsidy, and at what level? And then you would, if you're eligible for a tax subsidy, then you would be pushed into the plan selection process through the portal.
Now, what if I'm not eligible for a subsidy? I'm at 170% of poverty. I'm not eligible for...
tax subsidies actually go all the way up to 400%.
All right, I'm at 420% above poverty. Okay. I'm not eligible. What happens then? I don't get insurance from my employer.
Right, so you can still access coverage on the exchange. You just don't get a tax subsidy to help
pay
for it.
So after that point, I put in my information. I said I have no employer-based coverage. I move into the next exchange area, and what happens there? It presents basically these five plans are available to you?
Well, that's the plan, and I don't think we've seen what that will actually look like in many different states that are doing a state-based exchange or with the federal government. So we're still waiting to see exactly what that will look like. But yes, essentially the consumer would see the plans that are available in that state that they could then select, and they would have to determine what would be best for them and their family.
Okay, so here's plan A. It gives you X, Y, and Z coverage. It costs so much, and then, you know, minus your subsidy, it will cost you this much a month. And that's basically what's supposed to happen.
Supposed to.
Okay. What if I don't have high-speed internet?
Mm-hmm. So the law requires that everyone can have access to apply through an online website, through a paper application, or through the phone.
Okay.
And that's mandated by the law. So there are other options. States and the federal government will be establishing call centers, and there will be individual assistants on the ground to help people walk through a process, whether online or through an application. So you could potentially go and visit someone who's a designated navigator, is what they're called, to help you walk through the enrollment process. They might have access to an iPad or a computer where they can sit with you and do the application online or on paper.
I see. Oh, interesting. And so what's good? Just tell me what's the biggest challenge that you guys are going to be dealing with?
Well, we just completed some research that found 78% of the uninsured who are going to be eligible for coverage have no idea that this is coming. They don't know that there's coverage available for them, and they don't obviously know how to enroll in it. So our mission really this year is going to be identifying those folks, talking to them, messaging to them, motivating them to enroll, and explaining how.
And where are you guys located?
We're located here in Washington, D.C.
And how are you financed?
We have funding from several different sources. We get philanthropy funding. We're funded from some of our corporate partners. And if you take a look at our website, it's enrollamerica.org. About us, you can click and find the over 50 organizations who are partnering with us.
Well, thank you so much. Anita Feet, Director of State Assistance from at Enroll America.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Asif?
Hey, Sam.
Hey, we're on live right now.
We are? Okay.
There we go. So,
can you hear me?
Yeah, you know, I was talking to another buddy of mine giving me another film review, but I don't particularly like him. But he gave a good film review. Have you ever seen Four Lions?
Oh, yeah.
Good?
Yeah. I liked it. It's a movie that that I think it didn't get a lot of attention in this country, but it won a lot of awards in the UK. I think it's a satire about terrorism. So
right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Asif is joining us to. Well, there was actually two things. I mean, I wanted to get some film reviews from you.
Okay.
Because you're a well-respected actor and now and comedian and I guess correspondent on the Daily Show. And then I also wanted to ask you about the Lowe's thing and also about asking Rick Scott to pee in a cup.
All right, let's do it.
I loved it. All right, well, let's hear your first film review.
My first film review is a total plug for my own movie.
For what? For one of your movies?
Yeah, so I made a movie called Today's Special.
Today's Special.
Which came out in the Thanksgiving of 2010. It's a wonderful, if you like Indian food, and if you like a romantic comedy, it's a total like Indian food rom-com set in an Indian restaurant. It's heartwarming. It's funny. It's stars myself. The great Madhu Jaffrey is the star of Indian cuisine in the West. If anybody, all the foodies out there will know who she is. She's written 100+ Indian cookbooks.
Wait, what's her name?
And her name is Madhu Jaffrey.
Oh, you're breaking up a little bit. Madhu Jaffrey? What is it?
Madhu Jaffrey, yeah.
Oh, okay.
She is like, if you Google her, she's won 7 James Beard Awards, and she's like a cooking impresario.
Okay.
And so she's in the movie, myself, a legendary Bollywood actor, Nasiruddin Shah, who was in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with Sean Connery. We've got people like Dean Winters, who you guys all know from 30 Rock, and now the those commercials where he plays, he's crashing into trees and things all the time. And then a wonderful actress named Jess Weixler, who was in a movie called Peace. It's a great little movie. It's a really fun, heartwarming family comedy set in an Indian restaurant, and it comes out on DVD January 24th.
Is it streaming on Netflix? Will it be streaming on Netflix?
It's not streaming, but it is coming out on video on demand and on Amazon and on Netflix. You can rent the DVD.
Okay.
Starting January 24th.
All right.
If you didn't catch it in the theaters, it's playing there.
Well, I will probably watch it on Amazon because I'm not, that's my whole thing now. Is that, because my wife and my child, I'm not allowed to leave the house to go see a movie. And
Right.
I mean, who wants to spend $100 to go see a movie because you got to get a babysitter and then it's a pain in the ass.
That's what happens when you have kids. Then
yeah.
You have to, the whole going out to a movie becomes, this is why I feel like, this is the, our movie did, reasonably well in the theaters, but it was very difficult to get people out because people just aren't going to see movies the way they used to, because exactly for the reasons you're saying, it's expensive, you got to find parking, you got to, get a babysitter, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's a whole production, and it ends up costing you as much as it does to go see a Broadway play,
Yeah, exactly. Except for if you go see a Broadway play now, it's as if it's almost cost you as much as it would be to make your own movie.
Right. There you go.
You got all the same expenses, but then on top of that, the ticket costs $100 or whatever it is. So
Right.
I think to go out now, I mean, if my wife go out and we have just like a
a moderate price dinner for New York and go see a movie. I think it costs something like $7,000.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that's only if you go like down to the East Village.
That's right. A moderately priced, yeah. That's like one drink each.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
My wife and I cannot do that. We don't do the one drink each. If we're going to drink, we
right,
drink.
Right.
A separate
so,
issue.
Yeah.
So today's
so it's
special.
Hard. It's hard. Today's
what's your favorite?
Special,
what's your favorite Indian restaurant in New York City?
It's a restaurant called Dawat. Dawat.
Is that
on,
is on
the
Lex?
Upper East?
No.
It's on the Upper East Side. It's like 53rd. I'm going to get you the address. Hold on. I'm going to go on the internet.
Dawat.
And it's called, yeah, Dawat. And it's North Indian cuisine. It's wonderful. 10 East. Wait, hold on. Where is that?
There's nothing up by where we live, though, right?
Where are you?
I live around the corner from you. Remember we ran into each other up there?
Oh, right. You're up on the Upper West Side then.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is 210 East 56th Street, and it is it's terrific. And,
too far away. Too far away. That's right. That's where you got
away.
A kid. You got a kid. Forget about it.
Jesus. All right, so then on the Upper West Side, there's Sapphire. You ever gone to Sapphire?
No.
Sapphire is over by Columbus Circle, by the Time Warner building. You can walk there.
Yeah, not with a kid.
So that's.
I got to put her on the scooter. Forget
you know
it.
What? They deliver. They deliver.
They won't deliver that far to me.
They
I live right too far away. Forget about it. Forget about it. Do you know any good place to get a burger? How about a hot dog? Gray's Papayas, right on, right? Isn't there a Gray's Papaya out there?
Gray's Papaya's a hot dog. Yeah, you can get hot dogs with Gray's Papaya, but, you know, honestly, can you get that? Can you go that far?
Yeah.
It sounds like you're in like a, you know, maybe like a the most you can do is Fairway.
That's right. Exactly. I can make it to the Fairway, and that's it. My favorite right. Indian restaurant, it's not a fancy one. It is called Curry Leaf on 26th in Lex.
Yes, that's a good one. But how can you – have you been there?
Not in years.
Yeah.
Like literally from my wife's last birthday, I think it was, I went there. I took a cab down there, got the food, and brought it back up.
Right.
And
yeah,
sure,
how many children?
One, but it's but believe me,
you're
she's
only
a
one child.
She's a problem.
She's oh.
Not an easy child. She's difficult. All right. So what's the other movie?
Right.
What's the other movie that? That
so you I got a couple other movies. So there's a wonderful movie called Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Down.
Which Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go.
Which I saw on the airplane recently. I saw it on the airplane recently, and I was bawling my eyes out, and it was really embarrassing.
You know what, dude? That's the altitude, because I cannot. I cannot watch a movie on an airplane without crying. Like I swear to God, what was that
yeah,
one?
I watched Anchorman on there.
Cried.
I cried. Bawling my eyes out, but that was, you know.
What was that movie with Ben Affleck and where they went into the asteroid? Was that Armageddon? Ah, I cried during
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you were.
I cried
you were
during, that.
During that. You cried.
Cried.
During Armageddon. Well, that's a sad movie because, you know, there's something very sort of that affects something inside of us about the end of the world and stuff. So I can understand that in some ways.
It could have been I was crying about my life and somehow.
And it, you're
it was,
right.
It was all metaphorical.
Represented Armageddon.
Yeah, it was all yeah, metaphorical.
Yeah, I understand.
Never Let Me Go.
That's my other one. And then I've just been watching this documentary on, and this is easy because it's on YouTube. And there's and this is like totally if you want to, just as a bonus. There's a documentary about a Slovenian philosopher named Žižek, Slavo Žižek.
Oh, yeah.
Know this guy?
Yeah.
He's unbelievable.
Slavo Žižek.
Hang on one second. I have a guest showing up. Hold on.
Hi.
He's like a Slovenian philosopher. And he
he's been at the Occupy Wall Street, actually, I think.
Yes, he has. And he spoke at Google, and he's spoken at a bunch of different places. And he is the most fascinating person to watch. I don't agree with everything he says. He's kind of a, you know, he goes from, like, being a loon to, like, being incredibly, incredibly prolific. But he is the most interesting character. Like, he's mesmerizing to watch.
Huh.
He has all these tics, and he's like,
you're breaking up, buddy.
So he's a strange person who, like, has all these tics and stuff. So, yeah. So that's my third, and that's on YouTube. You can just watch it on YouTube, the entire documentary.
Sweet. All right, well, we'll check that out. Do you have to go? Do you have company?
I have to go, actually,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, we got in touch late. But we'll do this again, because this was fun. I enjoyed it.
All right, man.
I mean,
I'll
if you
want to
do
soon.
It. I mean, I don't want
to. I'd love to. You know, I always love talking to you, you know?
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, Asif. And
I prefer it on the street, but this is good.
If I can convince my my family, we'll go to Sapphire.
All right, great. You'll love it. You won't be sorry.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks, Oz.
Yeah. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Je ne peux pas.